I think, first of all, you read what we have, the description of higher mind, etc., starts from page number 939. So 939 to the end of this chapter is a description of all that. All right. You know, we have come to a very difficult portion of the chapter that we are studying, namely the essence of the super. We have covered two important points in this chapter. The first point was that you have to reach a high level of individuation in this process of ascent to the supermind. And we have discussed at length what is individuality, what is free will, which is a very important part of individuality. And we have discussed the second point, namely that the law of evolution operates in this process of ascent to the supermind. And in respect of this law of evolution, we have spoken of two important elements in this law, the law of ascent and the law of integration. You make an ascent to a higher plane, and when you reach a higher point, then there is a descent so as to absorb all that is below and to raise up all that is below into the higher. And then you reach a point of maturing the new level by a process of intensification, by the process of purification, by making that level more complex and more subtle. Complexity and subtlety, when these are increased, then again you have an ascent higher level. And in this process of ascent to the supermind, this law operates. And because of the operation of this law, you do not jump straight from our present level to the supermind, but there are gradations through which we pass. And this is the third point now we are coming to. What are these gradations? And we are to consider these gradations. We have already named these gradations. Sri Aurobindo has called them the higher mind, the illumined mind, the intuitive mind, the over mind, and then the super mind. So these are the gradations through which we pass. And these gradations are very difficult for us to understand. Even if you read the accounts given by these of these planes by Sri Aurobindo several times, they are difficult because they fall outside our normal experience. Even by analogy it becomes difficult. And yet, let us make an effort to understand to the best that we can. It will be a modest effort, but it may become fruitful. The word higher mind is a plane above our mind. And even to understand our own mind is first of all a difficult task, because our own mind has many levels in it. Usually we call this mind ordinary mind. Our mind is ordinary mind as compared to all these levels of consciousness. Now this ordinary mind has three levels: the physical mind, the vital mind, and the pure mind. Our ordinary mind, as I said, has the lowest level called the physical mind. Physical mind is the mind which is subject to physical concerns. It is subject to our bodily condition. If your body is very healthy, you feel everything fresh and wonderful. The physical mind is in a very happy condition. If our body is ill, things look gloomy and dark. So the bodily condition determining our mind. Secondly, usually the body has the habit of repeating mechanically. As a result of that, when our mind is subject to the physical, it has the habit of manufacturing repetitive ideas, mechanical ideas. The same idea going round and round and round and round. Thirdly, the physical mind has a habit of believing only physical things. Unless things are physically brought to it, the physical mind is not convinced. It demands a physical proof, physical perception of things which are talked about. To this mind, vital mind, pure mind, higher mind, illumined mind, all these are fictions. It takes only the physical reality to be the real reality. Everything else is imaginary. This is the third element of the physical mind. The fourth element on the physical mind is, it is prone to laziness, prone to inertia. So this is the physical mind is subject to the physical condition in which we are. It is subject to repetitiveness. It is subject to belief in physical reality. It is prone to lethargy, laziness, inertia, rest. These are the characteristics of the physical mind. This is the mind of which we have plenty of experience. Therefore, we can understand physical mind quite easily. Then there is the vital mind. Vital mind is the mind which is subject to the vital. And vital consists of impulses, desires, emotions, attraction, repulsions, ambitions, and various kinds of drives of imagination. And when the mind is subject to these, it is called vital mind. The normal experience of vital mind is what is called wishful thinking, the tendency of the mind to justify what we desire. Very often we tend to justify our actions and we put forward arguments to support our action, which may have been motivated by our desire. But we bring arguments which are mental. So mind is put at the service of the vital, so that mind can manufacture arguments in favor of the vital. So this is one of the examples of the vital mind. I like to see a certain film, and then my mind finds out many arguments as to why that film should be seen. It may be a desire to see a film, but the mind manufactures arguments to support that desire. It is an example of the activity of the vital mind. I may be driven by an ambition, and then my mind manufactures arguments to support that ambition. This is also called rationalization. Not rationality, but rationalization. To find reasonable arguments, rational arguments, for supporting what is not rational, what is in itself irrational, but you find out rational arguments to support it. This is called rationalization. Then comes the plane of the pure mind. Our normal, ordinary mind is usually clogged down to physical mind and vital mind. It is by a great effort that pure mind gets developed. And one of the objects of education must be to develop at least the pure mind. This does not happen normally, but this should be one of the basic elements of education. So the children are led to form an idea as to what is pure mind and to be able to exercise the pure mind. Even if many elements of pure mind are presented to the children, we do not make conscious of the child as to what exactly is the nature of pure mind. The speciality of pure mind is it sees something that is not physical. It sees. In other words, the pure mind is actually a mind of sight, but not physical sight. And we are not normally aware, even if you see mentally, we are not aware it's a kind of a sight. I usually give the following example just to give an experience of how the pure mind sees. I told you earlier this example, but I can repeat in this present circumstance. There was a lecture being given by a priest to a group of people. And he said that when he became priest, the first person who came to confess to him said that he was a murderer. That is a confession that he made. And then he went on lecturing. In the meantime, one man entered the room. He saluted the whole audience and asked for pardon for intruding and coming late. But he said that, well, I have taken liberty of coming late because I am very intimate with the priest. Because for him, I was the first repentant. Now, I don't know if you can see something. If you really see, it was not told physically, but you can see that he was a murderer. Two propositions are made, one after the other. At no stage you are told that he is a murderer. But now two statements are made. First statement says, told by the priest, that when he became the priest, the first person who came to him confessed that he was a murderer. Now this man comes and says that for him, he was the first person to confess. Now here there is no physical mind involved, no vital mind involved. Two propositions are made quite impartially. You are impartial. There is no involvement of your wish in it. You don't want to wish that this man should be a murderer. You are absolutely impartial. Your mind is absolutely pure. It has no bias, no prejudice, no favorable attitude, nothing. Simply two propositions are made before you. And the two propositions lead you that this man is a murderer. You perceive now, you are seen, not physically, but you are seen, your sight is awakened, and you see that he is a murderer. So the fact is that our mind is actually a faculty of seeing, and normally this we do not know. We only think that mind is something by which we think, we feel. Ordinarily we do not know as to what mind is, but first condition of the pure mind is, it is a sight, but not a physical sight, and yet it is a sight. Every sight is light. Or requires light. Normally we see this is only the light physically. And normally we do not think that mind is also light. But it is only when we experience that mind can see, and when you know that seeing requires light, that we can awaken to a light which is not physical, but a light which is invisible. And yet it is light nonetheless. Without the light you cannot perceive. It is what is called mental light, or light of the reason. Usually we are aware of ideas which are floating in our mind, but we do not know that there are ideas which are luminous, which are really light. Not all ideas are luminous. They may be physical ideas, mental, vital ideas. They also have some kind of luminosity, but very opaque. So in the ideas, realm of ideas, there are various degrees. Opaque light, diffuse light, fluorescent light, transparent light. So there are various kinds of lights in the mind, of which we are not normally aware. But if you reflect clearly, you will find these qualities of the light. There are certain ideas which you, when you begin to reflect upon, they become clearer and clearer. And you will find that when ideas are confused, there is a web of darkness. And as you begin to clarify this web of darkness, you find that this web of darkness was on account of errors. The greater the illusions and greater the errors, the greater is the confusion in the thought. And when you arrive at real clarity, you'll find that error has been eliminated and what is grasped is true. So there is a great connection between clarity and truth. In fact, there was a great philosopher called Descartes in Europe, a French philosopher. And he saw so much of connection between clarity and truth that he gave the definition of truth in terms of clarity. He said, the idea which is distinct and clear, is necessarily true. If you want to know whether it is truth or not, you just examine whether the idea is distinct and clear. And it is true that he who lives in truth, he will find a special quality in him, that his ideas are normally very clear, distinct, free from confusions, free from erroneous conclusions, bias, pure austerity, transparency, precision, distinctness. Even when complexity of ideas are present, they are like the rays of light put together, in which each ray is a straight ray of light and distinct from the other. Now, when you begin to enter into this pure mind, you are bordering the higher mind. Now, let us try to see some of the distinct and clear ideas of the pure mind, so that if you experience some of them and we become aware of them, we shall be able to appreciate better the higher planes of consciousness. One example that Socrates used to give is to lead the individual to define. He used to say that if you can define a word properly, you will get a distinct and clear idea of the thing in question. So one of the exercises of pure mind is the exercise of defining. There is a famous story about Socrates. A friend of his called Archibiades once went to Delphi from Athens. He used to live in Athens, but he went to Delphi, another town in Greece, ancient Greece. And Delphi was famous for one very important thing, namely the oracle. There used to be a temple, and the priest of the temple used to be always a very cultivated mystic, cultivated spiritual leader. And the priest used to be reputed for always answering questions correctly. So if anybody had any doubt in ancient Greece, then one used to visit Delphi and used to go to the oracle, put a question and obtain an answer and settle the doubt. Now this friend of Socrates went to Delphi and he asked the question, who is the wisest man? And Delphi oracle answered Socrates. That was the answer given by oracle. Socrates is the wisest man. He was very pleased because he was a friend of Socrates, and to find from oracle this testimony that Socrates was the wisest man, he became very happy. And when he returned to Athens, he called upon Socrates and said, look, you are the wisest man. And Socrates was shocked. It's not true. He said, no, but oracle has declared that you are the wisest. So Socrates, without being puffed up or anything of the kind, on the contrary, he said, for once oracle has made a mistake. I know myself that I am so ignorant. How can I be wisest? It's impossible. So he said, now I want to prove that oracles can sometimes be mistaken. I want to prove it, and I shall now prove it by showing that there are wiser men than myself. So he took upon him a task of interrogating all the wise people in Athens. And he went from one person to the other. He went to the poets, to the writers, to the statesmen, all those teachers, sophists, various kinds of people who were claiming that they were really wise, and whom Socrates believed they were really wise. One after the other, he went to every one of them and ultimately found not that he was wiser than anybody else. He came to the conclusion that all of them are as ignorant as himself. But they believed that they were wise. But I am ignorant and I know that I am ignorant. Therefore I am wiser than them. So he could not disprove the oracle. So this is his famous statement. I am wisest because I know that I am ignorant. Now, one of the methods he used in his interrogation was the method of definitions. Let us take one example. He went to one of the very renowned philosophers of his time, who used to be respected, and he used to believe that even he is even wiser than people believe him to be. That was his own personal opinion. And Socrates went to him with a great respect and said, "Sir, I want to know what is virtue." So that philosopher said, "What a simple question. Benevolence is virtue. Don't you understand? Generosity is virtue, gratitude is virtue, courage is virtue." So Socrates said, "You must pardon me because I am very poor in formulating my question. So maybe that I have not made my question so clear to you. My question is not what are virtues. My question is what is virtue?" And the man was incapable of understanding the distinction between the two. Virtues and virtue. What are virtues and what is virtue? He couldn't understand the distinction. So he again repeated. He said, "All right, if you want only one virtue, generosity is a virtue." So again he had to say, "I'm not asking you to give me an example of a virtue. My question is, what is it by virtue of which virtues are virtues? That is my question. What is it by virtue of which virtues are virtues? That is my question." And this was beyond the depth of this man. He couldn't answer this question. So this is the way in which he used to ask for definitions. And these definitions are purely activities of pure mind. How will you define a virtue? You make yourself this exercise and you will find a real exercise of the pure mind. You will understand what is pure mind. Let us take another example. You see two objects, bring two flowers. Here are flowers. Now you will see that each flower is different from other flower in some respect. But they are all similar flowers. Now Socrates used to say, "How do you know that they are similar? How do you know that these two flowers are similar?" And he used to answer by saying that because you are seeing something which you are not seeing physically, you are seeing, you know what is identity, by virtue of which knowledge you know they are similar. Identity you don't see anywhere. What you are seeing are only similarities. You are not seeing identities. You don't say that this flower is exactly identical with that. But unless you know identity, you will not say what is similar. Now by what means do you see the identity? Not physically. Physical mind doesn't say identity, vital mind doesn't say identity. Identity is seen by the pure mind. The pure mind seizes what it is to be a flower, basically. What it is to be a flower of this species. The identity of the species is seen not by physical terms. I mean, physicality always is similarities. Here is a group of horses. Each horse is different from the other horse, but they all belong to one species called the horse, which is not physically seen. The identity of horseness is not seen physically. It is mentally seen. So mind has a kind of a sense. It's a light. In this world, we very often ask ourselves, in modern times we say, what is the bottom line? This is a modern expression. Supposing somebody asks you the question after listening to my lecture, what is the bottom line? Now bottom line is not seen physically. What you see is, what you hear physically is blah 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 blah, what is going on. So many words, so many sentences, so much plethora of things told. What is the bottom line? And yet you are able to say the bottom line. Where do you see this? By what means do you see this bottom line? In sophisticated language it's called the essence. Bottom line is really the essence. What is the essence of the matter? Now essence again is never seen physically. You look at the whole world, you have never seen essence. Physically essence is not seen. And yet what is most important is essence. All manifestations are manifestations of essence. If essence does not exist, the manifestation doesn't exist. What is most important is essence.
Sir, ask a question.
Yes.
You said all the species, say by example the horse, but isn't that also the first place of physical conception, species, when you talk about differentiation of the species? But when you talk about essence, it's all right. How would you declare?
You see the horse as a physical form, and that is true, that is the basis. But on that basis, what you are not seeing physically is horseness. You have seen the physical horse, but physically you are not seeing the horseness. It is the horseness which makes a species distinct from any other species.
That's the knowledge beyond the sight.
That's right. By seeing the physical horse, somehow your mind is able to grasp what is not physically present. This is where the pure mind acts. Even though it may start with physical objects, it goes beyond the physical objects and understands physical objects better after going there. Even the physical objects are understood better after doing that. After listening to these lectures, so many sounds you hear, it is only when you reflect upon the essence of the matter that ultimately all that I have spoken becomes meaningful. Similar idea is the idea of all. The word all is a very curious word. In a sense, we may say all the persons sitting in this room has a specific meaning, namely 1 + 1 + 1 + 1 + 1, including everyone, all put together is all. All children happen to be naughty at a given stage of their development. All children happen to be naughty at a certain level of development. Now here I use the word all. Surely I have not seen every child in the world. In any case, I have not seen the children going to be born tomorrow. So they are not at present before me physically. So what is this, the image that I have when I use the word all? Surely it is different from the kind of image of all that I have when I describe all the people seated in this room. There you can say this is the meaning of all. But what is the meaning of the word all when I say all children happen to be naughty in their development? Which is the word all means what? All crows are black, whether I see it here or there or whether I am not seen. All crows are black. What does it mean? There is something like wherever the white color may be, always distributable in a spectrum of seven colors. Wherever white color may be, I have not seen all the whites. I have not seen everywhere. What is the meaning of everywhere? What is the meaning of all? What is the meaning of any universal? Universal is a term which we use in all our ordinary expressions. This object is black. Black is universal. That object is golden. Golden is universal. This object is particular, but the golden that is there is not confined only to this object. It is present in many objects, even which I have not seen. So although I may start a proposition from a physical observation, I am led by some curious method which is in us, which we call the mind, a particular sight which grasps the universal. If my physical mind does not grasp, my vital mind does not grasp. It is the pure mind which has this capacity. The universal, all, essence, identity, these are some of the examples which are grasped by the pure mind, which are seen by the pure mind. Not only that, but if you do not have these ideas, you can't even think. And this is very important. If you do not see these universal identity, even ordinary thinking is not possible. All our thinking requires these perceptions. There is a distinction between physical perception and thinking. Physical perception is seen by my physical eyes when there is a light, both in my eyes and on the object. All thinking implies the use of identity, essence, universality. All thinking, if you don't use this identity and universality, you will make an exercise. Try to eliminate these two elements and you will not be able to think. All thought processes involve these basic perceptions. The simple example that is given is, all men are mortal, Socrates is man, therefore Socrates is mortal. This is the normal logical example that is given in books of logic. Unless mortality, which is a universal quality, is understood, unless humanity, all men, is understood, you cannot come to a conclusion which is true of one this particular object. All our thinking processes involve the perception of universality, essence, identity. And this perception is a direct perception of the pure mind. These perceptions are really called ideas. Usually we use the word ideas for anything, but really speaking, the word idea should be used only for these. You might say they are parent ideas. Just as when I open my eyes and I see objects, similarly, the moment I really begin to think, you don't need to manufacture these ideas, they are directly perceptible. If you examine the question of identity, you will not be able to show identity anywhere in the physical world. There is nothing in the world which is identical with the other. There will be some difference. And yet you understand what is identity. Exactly, point by point it must be identical. Now this idea of identity which is directly perceived by your mind is, you might say, the real object of the pure mind. Just as these physical objects are the objects of my physical sight. Similarly, these ideas, there are not many of them, but these ideas are direct perceptions of the pure mind. There is something in the mind which is a sight. And the objects of this sight are the ideas of essence, identity, universality, at least these three, by the help of which all our thinking processes are managed. So that if they are absent, you can't think. Now, when you dwell upon this kind of thought process, the pure mind develops more and more. You will examine any kind of higher studies or any kind of study. All studies are basically nothing but definitions. When you study any subject, basically what you are trying to study is definitions. Even a subject like geography, if you want to study, which is purely geographical, physical understanding, without definitions you won't be able to understand geography. There are some minimum definitions around which the whole study of geography lies. Even physics, which is purely a matter of pure physical objects, physics is a study of certain basic words. What is atom, molecule, properties of density, what is magnetism, what is electric. You are constantly trying to find the concepts, the definitions. The more the definitions you have in your mind, the more precise is your clear is your mind. One of the best ways of educating children is to make child very clear and conscious of definitions of the words which are used. This is a quicker way of educating the child's mind. And the more developed mind is one which has great clarities of a number of definitions and plus something more, plus their interconnections. It's a new idea now. To see an object physically is one level of the physical mind. To define an object by the help of the concepts of essence, identity, universe, is an activity of pure mind. But this is the preliminary movement of the pure mind. But now you begin to perceive connections between ideas, between definitions. Normally it takes a long time for us to see the connections. There's a famous novel written by one great novelist, and in the front page of his novel there's only one line: there are connections. The whole message of the whole novel is there are connections. You want to be aware that there are connections. Of course, we all the time go on connecting things. But to become aware that we are connecting things, to become aware that there are connections in this world, is a new awareness, a freshness in the consciousness. When you see a connection between one and the other, really, you will feel a sparkling in your consciousness. When you see for the first time a connection between this and that, all detectives are in search of connections. And detectives have to be extremely clear in their mind, without any bias. Your mind has to function on the data available and find connections between them, and ultimately arrive at connections which are inevitable. This is the third idea I'm now putting. Connections which are inevitable. It is only when connections are established inevitably that you can be sure of the truth. So very often when we say, what is the truth? There are no direct, simple answers. A truth corresponds to a fact, normally. Secondly, truth corresponds to connections. And then, truths refer to inevitable connections. So a developed pure mind is a mind in which there are great perceptions of inevitable connections. A good detective, when he comes to your house on any inquiry, he sees inevitable connections between certain things which you do not know even about your own house, because he has developed his pure mind. What is true of a detective is true of a good lawyer, good doctor. Any proficiency depends upon this. A child has hiccups and she can tell you the connections, inevitable connections, as to why there are hiccups for this child, which you and I may not be able to understand. But an expert is one who has seen inevitable connections, and out of several inevitable connections there is one on which the good doctor goes straight to it and says, this is entirely because of this and no other cause. That is why the difference between doctors and doctors is this. Many doctors can say this may be because of this or because of that and because of that and because of that. But the real expert simply says, this is entirely because of this inevitable connection. Now, how do you see inevitable connections? It's also a sight. In the physical world, you don't see inevitable connections anywhere. Things are all pell-mell. What is the connection between this house and this chessboard? What is the inevitable connection? There is hardly any. Apparently, there seems to be a pure accident, a chance. It so happens. Why Anjali has organized this chess on this table? Just fancy. Looks nice. But a wiser man may be able to detect even what Anjali doesn't know. Why the chess? There is some kind of inevitable connection. Maybe it must be. So perceptions of essence, identity, universality, perceptions of connections, based upon these three basic concepts and perception of inevitable connection, these three layers of our pure mind, which is a large domain, is what we are capable of at our ordinary level. This is all ordinary mind. At the highest level, this realm of pure mind is what we have described. Now, when this mind becomes very complex, take for example one single book of Plato called Republic. It's a big volume. One of the most famous books of the world is Plato's book, The Republic. The subject matter of this book is, what is justice? The subject matter of this book is, what is justice? It is written in the form of a dialogue. And main person with whom the dialogue is made is Socrates. As I said, Socrates was fond of defining. And the main subject is, what is the definition of justice? That was the question. And various ideas of justice are brought forth. The whole book is various notions of justice. And after discussing so many definitions of justice, like justice is what the mighty thinks, is one definition. Justice is what mighty thinks, is justice. So many definitions are brought forth. I'm not going into that book now. It's a huge book in which the whole universe is analyzed. Because as a result of this kind of various kinds of definitions, Socrates is obliged to examine the whole world. After examining the whole world, he comes to one conclusion. Justice is a state where everything is in its own right place, in the right relationship with all the rest. This is his ultimate definition of justice. It's a state where everything is exactly where its right relationship brings it to be. And this is one of the greatest definitions of justice. You are just on what you need to do to that person. I may speak for 1 hour to this group and only 1 minute to another group. There's no injustice in it. Another group may not be so very keen as this group happens to be. Therefore, my relationship with this group is exactly appropriate, which may not be identical with my relationship with another object, another group, which may not have the same kind of keenness. If you have 3 children and you deal differently with each child, according to the need of each child, it is justice. But if children say, well, you did this to her and not to me, exactly, that is not justice. To each one, exactly according to the need, that is justice. So each thing is on right place, in right connections, in inevitable connections, that is justice. Now, such a book, such a huge book, and if you read the whole argument from beginning to the end, may take months. And then if somebody says, now you expound the argument, tell me the bottom line. You have to have a complete panoramic view of the whole argument to be able to tell you basically what it is. Now to hold that panoramic view is the beginning of the higher mind. I only say beginning because the still higher levels of higher mind are those where not only one panoramic view, but several panoramic views can be held together effortlessly. You don't have to make an effort. When your mind can hold several panoramic views together and also can interconnect them very effortlessly, then that state is called the higher mind. Once we grasp this, now the rest it is easier to understand. Once we understood the nature of higher mind, which is much simpler because it is easy for us to understand the pure mind. Once we understand the pure mind, we can understand better the higher mind because it is only more complex, much larger. Then you enter into illumined mind. Now you will see that actually in the higher mind or in the pure mind, I spoke of the sight of the mind. Sight which is not physical, but I spoke of the sight. But this sight is usually clothed in the form called idea. Every sight, identity, you have seen identity somehow, but you use the word identity as an idea to express that sight. Universality is a sight seen inwardly, but to express it you use the word universality, an idea. And normally our pure mind or even the higher mind usually uses the ideas to express its sights. But supposing you reach a point where idea becomes lesser and lesser and sight becomes more and more clear, then you reach a certain point which is similar to the following. I go to Egypt and I see the same object as this one. I see it, but I don't know Egyptian language. Arabic I do not know. How shall I express it? In what idea or in what word, what idea word I shall close it, my perception. So I understand this object, my sight grasps it, but I have no idea
to express it.
Similarly, you reach a higher level where the sight becomes very powerful, but the idea, it is so powerful a sight that there is no idea adequate to it. Here there was a question of not knowing a language, but there, at that higher level, the sight is so powerful that even the word or idea is not able to express it. This is something which you know, for example, in the case of experience of enthusiasm. A time comes when enthusiasm knows no bound for certain thing, for certain object. You become so enthusiastic that you do not have any word or idea to express it. But there is that experience in you which you can't deny. It's a powerful experience in you. You are full of it. You are consumed by it. Like sometimes somebody can be consumed by the zeal for God. Passion for God becomes so great that you can say, zeal for God has consumed me. Something like Sri Chaitanya, for example. You see God, the enthusiasm for God is so great, but there are no ideas or words to express them. Now, if that state of consciousness becomes more and more complex, in which all your sights become so powerful that there are hardly any words to express them, you find it very difficult to express them, then you have entered into illumined mind. Now, these are the areas which are more difficult for us because normally we are not having this kind of experience. Higher mind was easier to explain, I gave so many examples. But of illumined mind, it is much more difficult, excepting by saying that even in the pure mind, there is a distinction between sight and idea. An idea which expresses a sight not physical but a mental sight. Now you intensify that sight. Suppose, for example, you have entered into this room and you look at all the individuals here. You see physically all the objects. You are a good detective, you have found out the connections of those people by one sight, because you are a detective. But more than that, now you begin to see something else. The light that each one of us represents, the aspiration that each one of us represents. Supposing you have that perception. You enter into the room, you just look here, and you understand everyone here. Just by looking, you perceive the light of everyone, which is not physical, which is not mental even. It's a light. We normally think that light means this kind of light. By example of mental light, I told you there is another light which is other than physical. Now, in the illumined mind, there is another kind of light which is still different from the light that we have in the mind, in the pure mind or in the higher mind. It is light. You cannot call it by another name. It is light. Now, people may say it is impossible. Fine. But the light that you perceive with regard to the object of your enthusiasm is not purely mental. It's not an idea. Something much more. Admiration, there is love, there is a kind of aspiration to become identical with the object for whom you are enthusiastic. What do you see so as to become like that? You and I see the same object and you are enthusiastic, I am not. What is the difference between you and me? You are perceiving something which I am not perceiving. What is it that you are perceiving? What is the light that you are perceiving? That state is the state of illumined mind. When you see the whole world with that consciousness, in which there is a special kind of enthusiasm. The mind of illumined, the man who is filled with illumined mind is normally an enthusiastic man. He has enthusiasm for everything in the world. His enthusiasm knows no bound. He perceives something in the world. Now this perception, this sight is usually connected with sun. Actually every sight is connected with sun. Even my physical perception of a flower is a kind of a sound along with it, which I do not know, normally I don't perceive. But there is always a kind of interconnection between sound, vision, color, idea. There is a kind of interconnection. That is why you have the birth of arts. All arts are connected with sights, sounds, colors, ideas. Poetry is an art of ideas, or the highest literature, highest philosophy is an art of ideas. Sights and colors combined together are all kinds of fine arts. Painting, sculpture, architecture. Of sound is the music. All different kinds of arts are somehow connected with these ideas, sounds, colors, vibrations of various kinds. And the difference between one artist and the other is this. What is the quality of the sound that one hears? Not a physical sound, but there are sounds. Why is one poem better than the other? Because the sound of one poem is better than the sound of another poem. The rhythm of one poem is better than the rhythm of another poem. The combination of sounds and words which are put together in some poems are so powerful that the moment you hear them, your inner sound begins to vibrate immediately. ideas may be the same. Same idea is expressed in two poems. And yet one poem has expressed that idea in such a combination of sounds that the moment you hear, and when these sounds or these sights or these colors are put together in a certain measure, in what we call inevitable connections, then you get greatest pieces of architecture or music or dance or all arts. An artist is one who perceives these connections of sounds or vibrations of various kinds. You can be also an artist of life, not necessarily a musician or anything, but some of the great leaders of mankind are artists of life. They know how to connect relationships, human relationships, to connect human with the divine. There's also connection. And to relate divine and human properly, rightly, inevitably. When you can do this, you must have perceptions of that kind. You must perceive man, you must perceive the divine. There must be that light, that vibration. Great mystics are those who can relate themselves with God and relate themselves with others in the light of God. They are great artists of life. Christ might not have written a book or a poem or not composed any music or drawn any picture, but the relationship that he had with God, the inevitability of that relationship that existed in his life and with his fellow beings, it's a tremendous art of life. Buddha, the way in which he wrote no book at all, he composed no music in his life, drew no picture in his life, one of the greatest artists of life, as Sri Aurobindo says, is the greatest personality who ever walked on the earth. So as you rise higher and higher, I am only talking at present of illumined mind, but ultimately, as you rise higher and higher, these vibrations become more and more powerful, more and more luminous. Sri Aurobindo, while explaining, he has given the examples of some of the poems of Wordsworth, Shelley, Keats, Kalidas, Vyasa. If you see their expressions, the mode of expression, way in which certain things are expressed, they bring to you the messages, as it were, from the unknown, and they become lit up in your mind. The moment you hear those words, the mind becomes illumined. You understand it. A man may smile and yet be wicked. One sentence in Hamlet, very short sentence. A man may smile and yet be wicked. The brevity, the force, the content of it, the experience involved in it, so packed. It's a great perception. You can't easily write a sentence like this. Next time we shall read some of the poems of this kind. Some examples that Sri Aurobindo himself has given. How ultimately you get what is called mantric poetry. A mantra arises from the experience of the illumined mind, intuitive mind, overmind, supermind. Vibrations coming down from there. As the Rig Veda says about the Rishi, Rishi says, I go into the profundities of Yoma, supreme ether of existence, and there I hear the words, sounds. And these sounds as they come down, they are clothed in words in my heart. They are uttered. Rishi himself explains, this is the birth of that mantric poetry. Every verse of Rig Veda is born from these levels of consciousness. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, the supreme poets in the history of the world are Vedic poets. They have brought down the sounds which vibrate in these realms, the inaudible sounds, inaudible to us. When you enter there, you hear the sounds, like Beethoven, for example. Why do we hear Beethoven? What is the magic in it? The combination of sounds, the inevitable connections of the sounds, the cosmicity of the sounds, and the arrangement of these sounds, the flow of the sounds. So at times when you come to a climax, as if you live in the whole universe at the same time, such a climax is reached. Unless the poet has heard, the musician has heard those sounds, how can he reproduce here? These are some of the glimpses we get of these higher planes of consciousness. And many of these people are not even yogis. If you just enter into certain planes of consciousness, you begin to vibrate. Shakespeare was not a yogi in the sense in which you use the word yogi, although we should use that word yogi for him also. Anyone who makes a tremendous effort to break the limitations of our ordinary mind and begins to perceive the imperceptible, hear the inaudible, shruti and drishti, these are the two marks of the rishi in the Veda. One who has drishti and one who has shruti. One who hears and one who sees. One who sees the invisible and hears the inaudible and brings those sounds and those sights here. These are the experiences belonging to these higher planes. I think we shall stop here today, and next time we shall enter into a more difficult stage than what was today. Today was much simpler, and there our recourse will be only to read what Sri Aurobindo has written directly, so that we enter into those realms ourselves.
Alright.
Yes.
Would you like to
throw some
light on that today or the long topic?
No, it's a short topic. Indifference, no?
Yeah,
and social service.
There were two questions here. There was one, the difference between indifference and...
The real concern of yoga is to attain to a state of equality. That's the fundamental objective. Once I had asked the mother a question, what is the criterion by which you can judge that you have progressed in yoga? How do you measure your progress in yoga? The mother said, the extent to which you remain equal in all kinds of circumstances gives you the measurement of your progress. So you might say that equality is itself a definition of yoga. Yoga is nothing but a state of equality. Samatvam yoga uchyate. This is what the Gita itself says. The very definition of yoga is samatvam yoga uchyate. Yoga itself is nothing but equality, sense of state of equality. And really speaking, the highest equality can come only in the supermind. When you reach the supramental level, you really become absolutely equal. Till that time, we are all gradations of equality. In these gradations, detachment is one of the methods, not the method, but one of the methods. Because it is clear that so long as you are attached, you have preference for it. You have bias in favor of it. You like to possess, you like to enjoy it. Therefore, even the arguments mentally will go in favor of the attached object. There will be rationalization in regard to the object of attachment. Even the mind will not be pure mind. That is why it is said that detachment is one of the methods. It is called anasakti. Asakti is attachment. Anasakti is detachment. Therefore, some people use the word anasakti as the entire teaching of the Gita. Anasakti yoga, as it is called. The whole of the Gita is nothing but anasakti yoga. Now, in this movement of detachment, there are many levels. One very low level is the hardness of indifference. I'm using the two words deliberately. Hardness of indifference. In order to detach yourself from the object of attachment, sometimes you become hard towards that object. Instead of being soft all the time, because that is the mark of attachment. While detaching yourself, not knowing how to detach yourself properly, you become hard towards that object. It's the wrong thing, but this happens in the process sometimes. Not that it happens always, but sometimes it happens. You become hard to that object, and then whatever happens to that object, and whatever happens to me in regard to that object thereafter, I begin to develop what is called indifference. Because of that hardness of outlook, or attitude towards the object, I become indifferent. That is to say, whatever happens to me or whatever happens to the object of attachment, I say to myself, it matters nothing. I remain what I am, equal. Does not please me, does not displease me. In some human natures, hardness and indifference are associated with each other. Even some hard temperaments we will see, they are quite indifferent. And they might even be proud that they are having samatvam, some kind of equality. But this is a perverted indifference. Detachment does not mean hardness, but very often one becomes hard, and through hardness one develops indifference. Indifference is a state where it makes no difference to you, irrespective of what happens to yourself or to the object of your attachment. That's the meaning of indifference. When you find that it makes no difference to you, irrespective of what happens to you and to the object of attachment. And this indifference sometimes is brought about by developing hardness. Sometimes it develops by titiksha, by endurance. You do not become hard to the object of your attachment, but you detach yourself to some extent by which you try to remain equal whatever happens to your object of attachment and yourself. My child passes matric examination and I feel very, very happy. My neighbor's child also passes matric examination. I'm quite indifferent to it. It doesn't make any difference to my consciousness because I am attached to my child. But now if I cultivate this kind of detachment, and I say to myself, although this is my child, I love him very much, and normally my state of consciousness must be very exalted when my child passes the examination. I try to quiet down my exaltation. I don't allow the ripples of my exaltation to bubble up. This is also a state of endurance. You endure your exaltation and not experiencing exaltation. Something that is pleasant and you do not allow the pleasantness to enter into your experience by a psychological adjustment to the situation. It can come only by endurance. You endure the present experience, and by enduring, you neutralize the pleasantness. You bear the pleasantness. Instead of becoming excited, throwing big parties and so on, you just bear the happiness, contain it in yourself, don't burst out, is endurance. Similarly, if it gives you pain when the child fails in the examination, that pain may give you some kind of discomfort, to say the least, or great sorrow, or great suffering, great depression, disappointment, frustration, and you don't allow it to overpower you. That is also endurance. You endure the suffering without allowing your emotions to arise, or to, even if they arise, to make them weaker and weaker so that they don't overpower you. This method of endurance is called the Stoic method, the method of Stoicism. You endure. If I am given an honor in the country, the whole nation is going to watch me on television, and the exaltation that I may normally have. But by a Stoic method, I just don't feel that exaltation, or even if it comes. So whenever you hold out a certain emotion, even though that emotion is present, but I do not allow it to be overpowered, that is a Stoic level by endurance. There also you have indifference, whether I am honored or not. Although I feel happy, but I minimize that happiness by an effort. So result is some kind of indifference, but it's a better kind of indifference than hardness. When I use hardness, sometimes there's even a pride. Even if I'm honored, nothing happens to me. There also could be indifference. Nothing happens to me. I'm honored, so what? Doesn't matter. But there is an inner satisfaction of pride. And basically, it is not real indifference at all. It is actually exaltation of my ego, that I am not affected by it. So that indifference may be because of pride, or maybe because of cruelty. Some cruel men are very indifferent. Whether some people are undergoing great strain or torture or great happiness makes no difference. There is such a cruelty in the consciousness. And some people in the path of hardness, they either develop cruelty or develop hardness or pride. Now these are perversions. But some people are prone to this. In the name of indifference, in the name of detachment, they fall into this kind of a pit. And many natures fall into one of these pits, actually. So one has to guard against it. Some people who have very hard, very gentle heart, sometimes they become hard afterwards. Instead of becoming much more divine, they become harder because they undergo the practice of anasakti. And they need to be told that this is not necessary. You can be very gentle and yet be equal-minded, yet be indifferent. And one of the good methods is Stoicism, endure. But endurance is not something that is permanent. You can endure something by a great effort, but the effort doesn't continue all the time. So Stoic detachment or Stoic indifference that arises, detachment is the method, indifference is the result. By the method of detachment is a process by which you withdraw yourself from the object of attachment. So that movement of withdrawal is detachment. And the result that is obtained is indifference, state where whatever happens does not make any difference to you in your psychological being, is indifference. So since this state of indifference, this state of endurance cannot last all the time, some people can endure for a long time, but even they have got limitations. Effort, as long as it's an effort, is always temporary. It's not the natural state of being. It's not like jala kamalavat, like a lotus in water. Whatever water flows on it, it remains dry. It's jala kamalavat. The water does not make it wet. A lotus has not to make any effort. Its very nature is such that whatever wetness spreads over it, it remains without it. So Stoic detachment does not bring you this result. It can be a stage in your development, but it cannot be your real goal. A higher level is an intellectual perception of justice in the world. We discussed justice recently, just now. If you develop a perception in the world that everything in the world is in the right place, whether you recognize it or not, but if you develop an intellectual perception, you will find that at that given moment, everything is in a given right place. Then detachment becomes much greater, much more quiet. You don't need to have this endurance. Intellectually you perceive that everything happens. It tend to happen, it has happened, so what? Today I am victorious, tomorrow I may not be. I need not be. There is no pride, there is no cruelty, there is no idea that I am something fundamental, I'm in the center of things. This brings up a very important point. Basically, attachment arises out of putting ourselves in the center of things, which is called egoism.
You've been referring it to as an object of attachment all the while. It could be a opposite feeling also, something that you hate or dislike. Similar emotions can also be entertained.
But it can be applied similarly.
It's applicable to both the states.
To both the states. Attachment is only one example, but it can be applied to anything. Their emotions are unequal. So, when you see that you are not important in the world at all, if you see philosophically, largely, you find that you are only in a corner. Actually, every individual is in a corner in this world. Anybody think that he is in center is a wrong perception. He does not really happen to be in the center. Even if you are honored by television, so that you are on the television, the central hero, it's an illusion actually. 1,000 people may voice your praise, but if you look at the whole universe, well, the gongs of sounds are going on in the world, the universal rhythm. What is this voice of 1,000 people praising you on a television? Nothing. You are in a corner actually in the whole universal sound. This sound is simply a little burst, a cracker. So if you look at the universe so widely, you always find that everything in the world is in a corner. It is in a center only from a certain point of view, that's all. I am sitting here, by virtue of what I am talking, I am in the center. But to my mind, you are the center, because if you are not there, my talk has no meaning. So I am in a corner as far as I am concerned. You are the center. And from the universal point of view, neither you nor me is in the center. We are all in the corners. So if you have this wide perception of things, and always you realize that you are always in a corner, then detachment, indifference will be automatic. You want to make an effort, you don't endure. You just see really, even if 1,000 praises are showered on you, it will make no difference. It's only one little sound in the huge sound of the world which is going on. So it will make no difference to you at all really when you see in this large vision. This is called the higher state of equality, higher state of detachment, higher state of indifference, which is called philosophic detachment. The lower was the stoic detachment. This is called the philosophic detachment. Still higher one arises from your inner sense of resignation. You perceive that there is some reality which is the center of the universe. You are not the center. We are all in corner. But there is some center. That is the supreme divine is the center of the universe. And you have learned the art of offering everything to the supreme. Whatever experience you have, you just offer to the Divine and say, Idam na mama. This is not mine. This belongs to the Lord. You offer it to the Lord, and truly, heartily, then you will have not only a dry indifference, but some happy condition of indifference. You resign, you are offering to the Lord. Your child may become victorious and may win a gold medal, and realizes that his gold medal is because of the effort that you as a mother put into the child, and comes to the mother and says, Mother, I want this medal, but it's yours really. That resignation on the part of the child will not make him proud and will not be dancing about. He will have a real sense of equality. But it is not dry equality. There is a joy in it, a joy of giving, of offering. So although there is indifference, whether you win or not, even when you win, you are offering it away. It's not yours. You don't attach yourself to yourself. You offer it to somebody to whom it really belongs. And that gives you joy. So it's an indifference which is coupled with a joy, which is a still higher condition. So it's a detachment, indifference, but arising out of resignation. And the quality of indifference that arises will be quite different. Then there is a still higher level in which you find that everything here is an expression of the supreme ananda. All this world is a breath of ananda. And here there is no need of effort at all. Everything is mangalam. Idam mangalam, etad mangalam. This is mangala, that is mangala. You live in the sea of delight, where you lose nothing, you gain nothing. Everything happens, and everything gives you delight, equal delight. You don't have to make a stoic effort of keeping some emotions outside your being. You are constantly in a state of delight, whatever happens. You can't even now call it indifference. Now the state of indifference also is transcendent. The word detachment looks so petty. You are so attached to the divine, so much in love with them. So where is detachment? It's a huge love for the divine, huge ananda, and everything that happens is ananda. In that state, even the idea of detachment, the idea of indifference is washed out. And yet you have a pure equality. A true state of equality is the state of prasada, not of dryness, not devoid of smile, not devoid of kindness. It's full of grace, full of kindness, full of gentleness, gentler than a flower. In that vibrates the delight. And over all the creatures of the world, for everything, the same emotion spreads out. Greater than that is the action of equality. It's only a state of equality. Then greater than that is the action of equality, where although delight is everywhere, you distribute the delight in the right manner. You don't give to the child the dose of delight which the child cannot bear. You distribute the delight to every individual around you in the right measure, without any partiality for anybody, because basically you are bathing in constant delight. Therefore, whether you give this much or that much in the right measure makes no difference to you. So when your action is an action for distribution of delight in the world, passing through you, then whatever you do, there will be equality. This is the action of equality that Sri Krishna wanted Arjuna. Whether you kill Bhishma, who is your own grandfather, great father, great grandfather, and you win the battle and enjoy the kingdom, must make no difference at all. You have given to Bhishma what is to be given to him. You give to yourself what is to be given to you by an action which seemed to be sanguinary, bloody, horrible, ghoram karma, as Arjuna says. It was ghoram karma. But if you have seen this delight of divine, which he perceived in the 11th chapter, Vishwarup Darshana, having seen that delight of divine and the power of the divine, action of the divine, and Bhishma himself was so wise that he himself explained to Arjuna what is the secret of his death. He himself told Arjuna how to kill him. He himself was seated in that state of equality. So when you are seated in that state of equality, the action that proceeds is always just, the right. This is the word which is used by the Veda, Ridham. The right action is the action which proceeds from complete equality, from the universal vision of things in which everything is a manifestation of divine. Sarvam Priyam, this is the word of Veda. Priyam, what is Ananda in the Upanishad is Priyam in the Veda. Everything is delightful. And therefore you put everything in the right place. The distribution of your action, by which the forces of action are distributed rightly, so that everything is in the right place. That was the definition of justice. Everything is in the right place, in the right measure. That is the action of equality. And when you are seated in that condition, you don't have to make effort now. All effort is gone. Detachment is also a wrong word. Detached to what? Detached from where? Where everything is divine. How can you be detached from the divine? It's the utmost attachment to the divine. So even the consciousness of detachment goes away. Indifference of what? There is joy everywhere. There is no indifference at all in that state of consciousness. So both indifference and detachment are transcended. And you are in a new condition of a true equality. That samatvam is yoga in the Gita's view. When it is said that yoga, samatvam yoga uchyate, it is that action of equality, that is the ideal that we find in the Gita.
But the beginning is the individual equality which you have been referring to.
All this, depending upon your nature and your temperament at a given time. As I said, it is better to start with stoicism, endurance.
Which gives the equality to the individual.
To the individual. Then a higher level of philosophic equality, then equality by resignation. And then equality by ananda.